To hold forth at great length about all the wonderful gifts Victoria Barnett has given to me personally as a scholar of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Victoria Barnett is the staff director of church relations at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and one of the general editors of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Works English edition. Many of you have seen this. It's the ambitious translation of the 16-volume Dietrich Bonhoeffer Werke, and I guess there's a 10th volume coming out in a few weeks. This is a volume edited by Clifford Green on Barcelona, Berlin, America, the 1931 papers. I encourage all of you to subscribe to that series. We have, six more volumes are forthcoming? Five more are forthcoming. And Victoria Barnett is now the general editor of this extraordinary undertaking in Bonhoeffer scholarship. Victoria has written and lectured extensively on the history of the churches during the Holocaust and is the author of the definitive study of the Confessing Church called For the Soul of the People, Protestant Protest Against Hitler, which is just a fabulous book that reads like a Russian novel. I have had Vicky lecture on that to my undergraduate courses numerous times, and I highly recommend that book. She's also the author of Bystanders, Conscience and Complicity During the Holocaust. She is also the author of the essay on Bonhoeffer on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial website, which I encourage you to consult. Vicky is a doctoral candidate at the moment at the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. Also among her many translation projects is the new unabridged edition of Eberhard Baedeker's biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I think this is it's close to 1,100 pages long. So, wow, amazing. Thank you as well. And it's a fabulous book. But we're thrilled to have Victoria Barnett this morning lecturing on theology and conflict resolution.
Thank you very much. I now feel the burden of history weighing down upon me. I'm really appreciative of being in this group of people, and I'm thoroughly enjoying all of this. And I just want to say that at the beginning, that this is a tremendously important conversation. Most of the time I spend hanging out with either translators or historians. And so it's a real treat to have a different kind of conversation, and I just wanted to say that at the beginning. I'd like to begin by briefly describing the path that has brought me to my interest in this conversation, because I think it's very relevant for what I'm going to say today. My primary interest from undergraduate days on has always been the intersection of religion and political ideology. Don't ask me why, but I just think it's really interesting. This means that I have spent a great deal of my career looking at theology as a negative factor, if you will, at the ways in which theology becomes used as justification for violence, as an ideological tool, a cornerstone of power, an alibi. That is, theology as part of the problem, not the solution. My master's thesis at Union Theological Seminary back in the 1970s was titled The Ideological Risk. And what I did for that actually was a study of the 1979 Catholic Bishops' Conference in Puebla, Mexico. For those of you who know a bit of this history, and for those of you who don't, liberation theology within the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America really took shape at the conference in 1968 in Medellin, Colombia. And that opened up a whole new era within the Catholic Church of a real burst of theological energy on the grassroots, in which you had bishops and priests really working supportively with very poor people in shaping their destinies, giving them the theological language by which they could do that. And so there was this unfolding over the 10 years that followed, in many ways, juxtaposed with, of course, the rise of some very terrible dictatorships throughout Latin America. And so at the Bishops' Conference in Puebla in 1979, it was supposed to take place in 78, but they moved it to early 79, The question that was on the table was a very burning one of which way they were going to go. And it wasn't a clear-cut debate between black and white. You had some conservative bishops who were obviously trying to push back at the liberation folks, and you had some liberation folks who wanted to go to the barricades. But these were people on the ground working with very real-life issues of political oppression, torture, people disappearing. So there was a real question, not just of theological language, but of how you work with people who are at danger for their very lives and what they're doing. And so Puebla, the result was sort of a, you know, wishy-washy statement, because that's what church statements are. But the reality of Puebla was actually the discussions that took place there in Mexico, which were fascinating, not just between the liberation theologians, and everybody came. Sabrina was there, Ernesto Cardenal was there. Everybody realized that this was a really important conversation. And, of course, all the bishops were there. And all the community organizers from all these little comunidades de base were there with their pamphlets and leaflets and everything. And it was absolutely fascinating to dissect this conversation in terms of, you know, what they were talking about, where they were engaging political ideology, and where that shaped their theology. And what I observed was that actually everybody was kind of engaging the same thing, of course, in very different ways. But on all sides, there were very clear theological narratives that developed to justify certain political realities or to justify certain ideological perspectives, including the use of violence. And the risk that I identified in my very preliminary, it's kind of embarrassing to read through it now, but this, at the time this was what I was thinking about, was grounded in the observation that, of course, it's very possible for theology to become so engaged with an ideological argument that it loses its balance. That theology, I think, is always caught between this tension of wanting to retreat to the ivory tower where it's not going to do anybody any good and where it's going to become sort of this self-enclosed, meaningless world, and engaging with real-life questions, but those real-life questions are going to pull it in all kinds of directions. And if it loses its balance in a way that it loses its capacity for self-critique, and I say this as a person of faith, its capacity to listen for the voice of God that may be telling it something that it doesn't quite believe in terms of the worldview it has created, its capacity to keep asking questions, its capacity to alter to changing political circumstances while at the same time keeping the backbone of the faith that it professes. So that was my master's work. I went on from there to the study of the confessing church that Charles mentioned, and most of my work since then has been focused on the responses of the Protestant churches throughout Europe and in this country to National Socialism and the Holocaust. I think I got drawn to this because this historical event is perhaps the most well-documented and deeply pondered event in human history, and it has a great deal to tell us about how theology can be distorted by ideology. In the case of the Protestant churches in Nazi Germany, of course, the ideology of anti-Semitism, which was very much embedded in Christian teachings and understandings, so that by the 1930s it was something that was part of the air people breathed that they didn't even think about when Hitler began passing these laws. And the convergence in German history, and the history of the German Protestant Church, of Protestantism and nationalism. So that, again, by the 1930s, most German Protestants wouldn't have been able to tell you where their nationalism stopped and their Christianity began, because they really saw it as this convergence of things, and that helps explain why they responded to National Socialism as they did. This, in turn, led to my interest in the field of conflict studies. And so in September of 2001, I began work on my doctorate in conflict studies. Extraordinarily fortunate, because ICAR at George Mason University is a very international student body, so the days after 9/11, my conversation partners were people from Saudi Arabia and Israel and Pakistan and lots of other places in the world, and that was, I think, a very, very good thing. In addition to these people, I encountered a body of literature that both opened the door for me to understand religion in a new way, even as it helped to explain some of what I had encountered in my research on the churches in Germany. So this morning I'd like to talk about how lived theology can transform a conflict both for better or for worse, and what this tells us about how theology works, about the dynamics of theology and conflict transformation. I actually prefer that term to conflict resolution because most conflicts don't really get resolved, but they can be transformed. And how perhaps we need to think of theology as lived in both directions, as both subject and object, as a transformative force that can shape conflict, and as a force that in turn is shaped by the battles it chooses and the narratives it embraces. So I'll start with a few remarks on theology, and then a few remarks on religion and conflict, and I'll end with the obligatory Bonhoeffer quote and concluding reflections. Theology. The power of theology, I think, lies in this volatile, highly combustible combination of elasticity and the absolute. Theological narrative is elastic. It responds to history and human need. It changes its story to fit the times and the language. At the same time, it always has this core or this expectation of the absolute, because even in the smallest circles, it can offer what seem to be universal, uniform narrative with rules, principles, and God talk. And so even a theological narrative that is so new that it would have been unrecognizable to a previous generation is given the weight of universality and a tone of permanence. Scott Appleby, in his book, The Ambivalence of the Sacred, puts this very academically. He says, religions, even as they have an identifiable core of distinctive and abiding characteristics, religious traditions are adaptive and constantly changing in form and expression. That's the academic jargon, but in real life, this can really be horrific. And the case study for this, I think, is what happens to the church in the 20th century in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, where you see some of the greatest theological minds of the century, the German theologians, who begin to reinvent and re-narrate Christianity so it fits the Arian concept. They reinvent their notion of Germany so that it becomes a moment in salvation history. And in the process, they begin to reinvent notions of good and evil and decency so that ultimately these moral values are seen as a justification for the arrest, torture, and murders of millions of people and for the beginning of the war and for the war itself. The scary thing about Nazi Germany is it has a very coherent moral system. Anyone would recognize it. There are rules. There are expectations. They think of themselves as decent people. Himmler, in his famous speech in 1941, says, you know, history will remember us because we were decent people who had to undertake the most horrific things imaginable, but we did it and we still remained anständig decent. That's how they thought of themselves. So theological narrative is extremely elastic because so many Christians went along with this, rewriting their liturgies and their hymns and their theologies to fit this new scenario. And one reason it's so elastic is because I think theological discourse is actually a conversation that is always ongoing, always on several different levels that shape and form one another and are constantly thus changing really the way we think about our belief in this moment. Just looking at Abrahamic theological discourse, the Jewish tradition, Muslim tradition, Christian tradition, you have a narrative or a discourse that's within the tradition. Okay, Christians, theologians discuss among themselves what Augustinianism is, what it means today, what the teachings are, how we understand certain forms of scripture. The other traditions do that as well. It also takes place always either directly with the other, with another tradition, or with the other tradition in mind. Christianity defines itself vis-a-vis Judaism. It defines its understanding of salvation history in light of Jesus' roots in Judaism, but then what happens after that? So there's this ongoing shaping of the narrative that has this other tradition as at least an invisible conversation partner. And discourse always happens on a third level, the larger level, of historical, political, social, cultural context in which we live. These multiple levels of discourse mean that even as we attempt to describe, respond to, perhaps even change our historical circumstances, we are always in turn being shaped and changed by them, especially at the cultural and political level. part of the ideological risk stems from this absolute nature of belief and the sense that in the religious dialogue with our society, we have some kind of mission, that we as people of faith have something very specific to bring to it, and that we have a mandate to do so. I think every religion has a certain element that is could be described as this Achilles heel, an inherent weakness, a trigger that makes it liable to certain kinds of transgressions. And I think that for Christianity in the first world, I would limit this to European, North American Christian traditions, I think that our Achilles heel is the relationship to power, the sense that we have a mandate to mandate justice within the larger society. And the way that this shapes us, I think, comes in part not from our belief, as by virtue of the fact that in Western Europe and in this country, Christians make up 85, 90, 95% of the population. We are used to being the majority. We are not used to being anything but the majority. We think of our values and our traditions as normative. We think we own the place because we do, we have. And I think that this, in turn, very much shapes the paradigms by which we explain certain things, the calls to action we issue across the ideological spectrum of Christianity, I would say. I don't think this is just a conservative problem. I think that those of us on the left have the same issue, that we tend to think in these ways because this is how our tradition has shaped us in this particular in terms of our history, in terms of our culture in this country. I often ask groups that visit the museum, we have a lot of church groups, a lot of seminary groups that visit the museum, and I say, try to think for a minute of what your theology and politics would look like if Christians were 1% of the population. That's what everybody else is. We talk about religious diversity in this country, but if you look at the Pew Forum website where they, you know, regularly get statistics, 85% of the American population considers itself Christian. Nobody else is above 1%. Jews, Muslims, I mean, all the groups are very, very small. And that very much shapes our discourse in a way that I think we need to self-reflect on. It's not a bad thing to want to act for justice. We just have to think about how we're doing this in faith terms, given the fact that even if they're minorities, we have other religions here, and given the fact that when Christians act from a tradition of power, an understanding of power, that's not always a good thing. We like crusades of all kinds, and this is our weakness. This is our inherent flaw that we need to be aware of, and that's what I mean by the ideological risk. As people of faith, we cannot engage in the world without engaging these kinds of conversations, but as soon as we enter the dialogical terrain, it is very difficult to avoid getting pulled into its terms. And that, in turn, does certain things to our conception of our own faith. This is why Karl Barth, of all people, was so influential in the Confessing Church in Germany. Now, I have to tell a story. At Union Seminary in the 70s, my class on Karl Barth was co-taught by Dorothee Zola and Christopher Morse. That doesn't want to say things to many people, but Christopher Morse was this very genteel Barthian scholar, one of the leading Barthian scholars of the world, really got inside of Karl Barth's thought and had tremendous respect for the man. And Dorothee Zola was a feminist German theologian, outspoken, on really a prophetic voice, not just within the German church, but internationally. And she couldn't say the name of Karl Barth without four or five pejorative adjectives that preceded it. So she would stand up and say, well, as the patriarchal, hierarchical, neo-capitalist theologian Karl Barth once said, and Christopher Morse would say, now, Dorothy. So it was a fun class. But for that reason, when I began to look at the Confessing Church, and my first book was actually a collection of oral histories that I did of people who had been in the Confessing Church, and I was really surprised that people across the spectrum, Helmut Gollwitz or Martin Niemöller, lots of people who, you know, fit on all points of the spectrum, all said to a person, there would not have been a Confessing Church without Karl Barth. And why? Because Karl Barth, in that particular historical moment, his notion of a God that was outside of human control, outside of history in a sense, that couldn't be reined in to an ideological worldview that had the Führer and all these new notions that were coming up in German Protestantism, that Barth gave people the backbone to do what they did at the Barmen Confession, or the Barmen meeting in May of 1934, when he wrote the Barmen Confession of Faith, where they said the true Church of Jesus Christ has allegiance to two things alone, Christ and the Scripture. That's it, you know. And Barth had the sense of, had the gift of pulling people back from their ongoing conversations where they were redefining themselves and saying, whoa, you know, Scripture, Christ, that's it. Just remind yourselves every day when you go out into society, the churches have swastika flags hanging in them, where they're rewriting the hymn books. Pull yourself back, remember that. The Confessing Church failed in many ways, but that was its radical core, and it was a core that had precisely this energy of pulling them back from the worldly forces that were drawing the conversation in another way. It's the same dynamic, I think, that does lead and can lead to positive redemption and change. It's not that theologians shouldn't be engaged with the world. It's just that we have to be self-reflective, self-critical as we do it. We seek a theology with a different narrative, and we search within the different traditions for the beliefs and narratives that can keep us whole, that can transcend difference and violence, that can bring about peace and reconciliation. And when we do so, we return again and again to the core teachings. And the language of peace, perhaps, is a good way of describing that. But it's interesting because there's a huge and growing body of literature in the field of conflict studies about religion's potential for doing just this, for transforming violence, for resolving conflict. Several years ago, there was a book on humanitarian intervention by a legal scholar named Brian Leppard, and it's called Reinventing Humanitarian Intervention. And he was trying to make the case that humanitarian intervention is a universal principle because the majority of the world religions, to which 75% of the world's population belong, have a very similar religious foundation for humanitarian intervention in terms of their universal religious tenets and principles. Love one another, help one another. I mean, all the religions have this. And so Leppard says, look, you know, some critics say that humanitarian intervention is a Western invention, but really this is a universal principle that we should be drawing on, that we should be drawing religious scholars into this conversation to make the case across the world that this is a principle that can be defended not just politically, but in terms of religious teachings. So why don't we all get along? The problem, of course, is that while all these religions have core teachings that are imbued with the language of peace, their actual historical record often tells a very different story. And I think that Christianity, actually, if you look at Christianity through history, perhaps has the worst record of all. It's certainly way up there. Certainly no religion in history has been as consistently on the side of political power, oppression, and violence as Christianity, not just in the Holocaust, but in the conquering of the New World, in the story of slavery, in lots and lots of different ways. So it's not as easy as going back to core principles of love for one another. And yet, perhaps the problem lies somewhere else. So I come to part two, which is the observations that non-religious scholars in the field of conflict studies have to make about religion when they look at it. And this gets very interesting, because when you look at the data on conflict, there is evidence that in reality, religion is seldom the starting point for conflict. The role of belief, and yes, theology, seems to be correlated with and determined by some very non-religious factors. One of the most extensive research projects of modern times is a huge data set called the Minorities at Risk Database. Has anyone ever heard of this? Oh, this is fun. Next time you're sitting at your desk and you don't know what to do, Google it. And you can get in there, and what it is all the available statistical information between 1945 and 2000 on 337 ethnic minorities that are politically active and have been involved in serious ethnic conflict. So you pull up all these big conflicts and small conflicts, and they've put every number in that they can find. to sort of look at the dynamics of all these conflicts and see if they can learn something about them. Now, the great thing about things like this is you get people from all different disciplines looking at them and saying interesting new things. But the person who has taken this the farthest in terms of religion is a professor of political science at Bar Ilan University in Israel named Jonathan Fox. And Fox has devoted the past decade to studying these statistics with respect to the role of religion. He has a very interesting book titled Religion, Civilization, and Civil War that I can highly recommend. And what he discovers is very interesting because the bottom line, without going into all of the stuff he looks at, is that despite the fact that religious factors do indeed come into play in such ethnic conflicts, that religion is seldom in and of itself a salient feature, determining point in the conflict itself. Religion, he says, is significantly measurable in only 17% of the ethnic conflicts in this database, even in conflicts that are called religious conflicts because you have different ethnic groups of different religions on either side. So when does religion become the fault line? Because Fox observes that it does indeed become the fault line. And according to Fox, it's when things fall apart. It's when the disintegration of civil society reaches a certain point, the level of violence reaches a certain point, when institutions collapse, when the economy spins out of control. These are the circumstances in which religious identity suddenly seems to take a new level of power and can become a very destructive force. I did a white paper on the Sudan conflict a few years ago, and I was looking not just at what's happening in Darfur, but at the civil wars of the 1980s and, you know, the past 40 years really of conflict in that country. And once in a while, a statistic will just jump out at you, and the statistic that jumped out at me was that by 1988, 83% of the civil service in Sudan had left. They got out. The people who were judges, the teachers, the principals of schools, people who design curriculum, the engineers, people who repaired the streets, the people who kept the sewer plant running, anyone who could get out of that situation got out. So who's left? Who runs the country? The military. The extended family of General Bashir. And the paradigm that we now use when we see Sudan and discuss that conflict is that this is an Islamist regime. Political Islam has taken over. I mean, there's a certain religious paradigm that dominates the discourse about that conflict. But at its heart, you know, you can look at other facts about that history that explain much more why what has happened has happened. I think of, you know, your statistics about the different numbers in the Congo and other places, which are conflicts which are spillover conflicts. They happen because something has pushed, you know, something has happened in another part of the world that spills over into them and utterly changes the dynamics. And in that scenario, religion, like lots of other things, becomes a dividing line. It becomes a battle point. But to look at that only in terms of the theology or the belief system or the religious tradition is a mistake because that's not what has been pushing it. It's other things. And to the extent that theologies emerge from that, they're in conversation with this much greater force. And you can think of other instances. I mean, the former Yugoslavia. Under Tito, you had Orthodox Christians, Roman Catholics, and Muslims living together, intermarrying. You had what seemed to be a cohesive society, which very quickly falls apart in the early 1990s. Or even Germany in the early 20th century, which was one of the destinations for Jews fleeing the pogroms in the East. They felt that the level of anti-Semitism in Germany was less than it was in France. That Germany was a country where they could assimilate and actually fit into the society. And yet during the Weimar years, where you have 15 different coalitions, high inflation, just a confabulation of circumstances that break everything open. And in that scenario, the folkish ideologies take new hold, new political directions emerge, and theological narratives emerge along with them. So to understand religious violence or even religion and conflict, I think we always need to go beyond belief. Rethinking theology may actually be secondary in some of these cases, because when we speak about religious violence, we're talking about the intersection between religion and ethnicity, religion and culture, the complicity or involvement of religious institutions and organizations, the intersection of religion and civil society, the intersection of religion and ideology, at which point we're looking at the politicization of religion or ethnicity or a combination of the two. We may also be looking at tensions between traditionalist and secularist points of view. Religious conflicts may, in actual fact, be conflicts over land or between majorities and minorities that have become framed in theological language. We're looking at how religious leaders and institutions choose to respond to a conflict. And that means we're looking at institutional dynamics, at issues that confront not just religious bodies, but other NGOs and other organizations that find themselves. We're looking at different alliances. Particularly in this historical moment now, I think, we're also looking at expressions of religion that function transnationally, at religions as a means of uniting certain people across national boundaries, at the solidarity between Sikhs in India and in Canada, or between Jews in Israel and Jews in the United States, or between Muslims in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and England. So we live in an age in which identity, especially religious identity, is effectively a form of self-defense against other faiths, against oppressive governments, in the name of liberation, against globalization. And so it should come as no surprise that we live in an era of religious violence, although there's so many other things packed into that. All of these factors, in turn, shape what we're trying to get at, the language of peace. How do we think about this in light of all these incredibly complex dynamics? Religion is indeed an expression of belief and conscience, the vessel in which certain traditions are held and preserved, but it's also a construct. It's always a construct. And so it's naive to think that belief or theology is unaltered by the alliances we make and the positions we take, or that the political alliances of the faithful represent the pure expressions of their belief. One of the central lessons of my own research on the churches during the Holocaust is the extent to which religious language was used in that era to express other things, and the very great and terrible lengths that religious groups will go to accommodate themselves to a social and political agenda and give that accommodation theological language. Religion, theology, is elastic. The power of religion, especially of its theological language, derives not only from its content, but from its context. And history tells us again and again the degree to which context influences and reshapes content. Theology only has potential for conflict transformation to the extent that it remains possible itself for transformation, ongoing self-reflection and self-critique, i.e. that it retains a certain critical distance to parties in the conflict and to what we assume are the paradigms, that we keep a critical eye on those paradigms, on our tendency to absolutize or reify a political position using theological language. So what does this mean for lived theology in a positive sense? This is where Bonhoeffer is so interesting, part three. We tend to think of Bonhoeffer, I think Bonhoeffer, sort of the Bonhoeffer of screen and popular novels, is a clear-sighted, prophetic voice who saw from the beginning what was going on, tried to push his church in that direction, didn't work, so he joined the resistance, became a martyr, and there's a certain Bonhoeffer narrative. Because I have all of his writings on my hard drive, and you have to think of what I do in this day job, is I sit down and I read, you know, his letters to his grandmother, the footnotes, his letters to his students, a draft for a sermon, student notes from his lectures, everything imaginable. And when you look that close up at someone, I mean, you should never wish this on anyone. But when you look that close up at anyone, you begin to see that he's a human being with doubts, makes some compromises along the way. Right now I'm editing volume 12, which covers the period in Berlin in early 1933. And at that point, you know, he's speaking out against the regime. This is where he gives his radio address about the danger of the feudal principle, where he writes his essay, The Church and the Jewish Question. He goes to the ecumenical meeting in Sofia, Bulgaria in September, and they push through a condemnation of Nazi racial laws. Immediately after the meeting, he and Julius Richter run to the German consulate to deliver a letter saying, this is not a criticism of the political regime, this is a church conference. That's Bonhoeffer in 33. There are lots of little moments like that where you can see him covering his back. He's worried. He's not quite sure where all this is going. He's trying to find his way. It's very moving to actually watch him in the 1930s. This is why he leaves Germany so much. I mean, you know, he wrestles with all this stuff, and then he goes to London for a year and a half, and then he comes back to Germany and teaches in the middle of nowhere and teaches all these students, and then he decides it's time to go, you know, over to the United States. But then he comes back, and he joins the resistance. And this whole path, I think, makes him very reflective of what is happening to him, to his theology, to his church. And that, I think, is actually Bonhoeffer's contribution to our discussion today. Because in Bonhoeffer, you have volumes of this kind of self-reflection in the middle of an ideologically charged time, which is pulling Christian tradition in all kinds of frightening directions. And Bonhoeffer is looking at this and thinking about what it means to be a Christian and trying for himself. I mean, he really is trying extremely hard to return to the core, to get a sense of what Christ is calling him to do, of who Jesus Christ is for us today, of what the church in his circumstances should be about. And so in Christmas of 1943, he writes this little essay called After 10 Years, which he sends to several of his fellow co-conspirators. And if you've known, this should be, you know, a handout. This should be in every hotel room. If you haven't read this, read it. Because there you see the Bonhoeffer I'm talking about, somebody who is trying to keep his footing and thinking not only about what that means for him as a Christian, but what it means for his country, for his friends. And so he's got all these little sections in After 10 Years where he's talking about different aspects of this. But the section I want to mention this morning is a section that is called Who Stands Fast? Who has the wherewithal, the theological, spiritual, political wherewithal to stand up against what is happening under National Socialism? And it's a very challenging passage of his writing because he dismantles and critiques all the usual underpinnings of what we would expect to be ethical and, yes, theological behavior. He says, who stands fast? Well, it's not the man of reason. It's not the person who has single-minded devotion to a principle. It's not the man of conscience. It's not the man of duty, the advocate of freedom, the people grounded in virtue. He kind of ticks all these things off that you would think, well, the man of conscience, isn't that what this is about? But he says, no, this isn't going to work either. None of these attributes, he says, can withstand the challenges of Nazism. Who stands fast, he writes, only the man whose final standard is not his reason, his principles, his conscience, his freedom, or his virtue, but who is ready to sacrifice all these when he is called to obedient and responsible action in faith and in exclusive allegiance to God. The responsible man who tries to make his whole life an answer to the question and call of God. That's a really challenging, you know, if you had a hypothetical list of presidential candidates and man of conscience, man of, and you had somebody who said, yeah, I'm following the steps of my Lord, that's the first one I cross off. But you know, this is, Bonhoeffer is talking about something else, not political candidates, but somebody who can withstand the ideological risk. And in a way, it's interesting. The quotation yesterday from Martin Luther King, the end of life is to do the will of God come what may. That's kind of what Bonhoeffer is saying this. It's about doing the will of God. Lived theology, emphasis on the lived, includes the capacity to move where your theology has not yet taken you. I often describe Bonhoeffer as an unfinished theologian because he didn't live long enough. He was killed in 1945. He didn't live long enough to complete a lot of the thoughts that he begins during his resistance period. But I would contend that the historical instances in which something theological happens that leads to a profound historical change the instances that really do transcend what we expect to have happen are those in which the theological actors have transcended even their own traditions and in so doing broken new ground in their tradition. And I look at King in that light, and I see Desmond Tutu and the work of the TRC in South Africa in that light. I think that what happened in Eastern Europe was remarkable in that sense when you look at some of the people involved in that. Or Pope John Paul II at Auschwitz and at the Wall in Jerusalem, really stepping outside of his tradition in a way that didn't have a booklet to explain it, but it was a symbolic gesture that actually pushed the Catholic Church to a new position. These are all instances that show the political power of the theological imagination. But they are moments. I still don't know how to give them a theological text, but I also think that it's dangerous to do so. They're modest in that sense. The theology that emerges from such moments has to stay true somehow to the simplicity and directness of that moment. So I really like Victoria Gray Adams's answer to your question that, say, what do we have to do now? Well, seek the language of peace. That should keep all of us busy for some time. And so I will close there. Thank you.